Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, collisions on I-10 eastbound at Warner Road, also the 51 northbound at the Thomas Road on-ramp, and there's a collision blocking the shoulder on the 202 westbound at 32nd Street. We'll stay partly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley, looking for a high temperature only in the double digits at around 99 degrees, and then for tonight, partly cloudy with a 40% chance for rain. It's currently mostly clear and 95 degrees at KJZZ. Republican vice presidential candidate Mike Pence will be in Arizona tomorrow to hold two town hall events. KJZZ's Carrie Young has more.
This will be Pence's first visit to the state since joining Donald Trump on the Republican ticket 2 weeks ago. Tuesday's events in Tucson and Phoenix are expected to last about an hour. The campaign would not discuss how attendees can get the opportunity to submit and ask questions at the town halls. Brian Sychik is the state director for the Donald Trump for President campaign in Arizona.
All that'll be worked out tomorrow, and that'll be fully explained tomorrow once everybody arrives.
Okay, so you guys don't have a game plan for that setup?
No, we certainly do, but we're gonna be late to announce all of that tomorrow.
In addition to Pence, local political leaders like Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Arizona Republican Party Chairman Robert Graham are also expected to attend. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's primary election is coming up later this month on August 30th, and early ballots go out later this week. But if you're not registered, then it's time to get on that, because today is the deadline. To talk more about that, I'm joined by Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan. And Secretary Reagan, what do unregistered voters need to do today if they're interested in this month's primary?
Well, first thing that they need to do if they really want to vote in the primary is to get registered, and they have until 11:59 tonight to get registered to vote. You can register online, which makes it really handy. If people want to register in person, they can go to their county recorder's office and register, but then you got to do it by 5 o'clock this afternoon. So the best way to do it is to hop online, go to arizona.vote or to servicearizona.com. And either one of those websites can get you registered online. You just need your driver's license handy.
And most of us enjoy the convenience of doing stuff online, but there are also some folks out there who are trying to scam people who are trying to register to vote either for the first time or just to re-register. What's out there? What are some scams we need to watch for?
We were kind of surprised this year to receive at our own office some very suspicious-looking emails that looked like it was a couple of different entities trying to fish and try to look for some personal information from folks. Looked like they were trying to entice people to enter their personal voter information and make it look like perhaps they were official voter registration sites. So we're urging people, if you want to register to vote, which we want you to register to vote, get yourself registered. Just make sure you're going to one of the official voter registration sites.
There's been talk for years about when Arizona's primary is scheduled. I know you don't have control over that, but it's still going to be really at the end of summer, being the end of this month. Are you hopeful for a big turnout? Do you expect a lot of that to come from mail-in? Have you looked at any of that yet?
Well, you know, we always hope for a big turnout. We'd love to see turnout go up, but I've actually, when I was in the legislature, was an advocate and still am an advocate for moving that primary back a bit when it's a little bit cooler in the spring. I'd prefer to see the primary be when some other states do it, in May or in June. But for right now, it's not in May. It's in August. And so we do what we can to educate people and to get them interested in voting in the primary.
Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan. Arizona's Senate, congressional, and legislative primaries are indeed coming up August 30th, and with later this week, early ballots will start arriving in your mailbox. Senator John McCain will be defending his seat against former state Senator Kelly Ward, and until last night, he was also being opposed by Alex Molusky. That's when Molusky announced he was suspending his campaign. With me for an update on the U.S. Senate race is Republican strategist Shane Wickforce of Red Mountain Consulting. Shane Molesky has spent a lot of money but hadn't gained much traction. What do you make of this decision to suspend his campaign?
Well, first of all, the timing of his suspension announcement was on a Sunday, which is a low media day, and I think that that was probably planned to avoid some of the controversy or drama that goes with a suspension of a race. The other thing to note is that he did not make an endorsement of Kelly Ward in this race, and it's to be seen whether or not he does come out in support for her. He has spent a tremendous amount of money, I think it's north of $788,000, to try to gain a name ID in this race. And with the polling showing him in single digits, it just was not going anywhere. It's very hard to beat somebody who has been in office for over 33 years with pretty much 100% name ID. And that's been the biggest challenge for Kelly Ward is to try to do that. So I don't think that him dropping out of the race will have an impact based on where the polls are now. But if it was a much tighter race between Kelly Ward and John McCain, it could have an impact.
Shane, the McCain campaign denied this very strongly. Man, there are always little speculations about different things in political races. Did you put any weight in the possibility that Molesky was in the race to sort of draw votes away from Kelly Ward?
You know, Steve, that has fueled a little bit of the conspiracy theories out there about Molesky being a dark horse to try to siphon off votes away from Kelly Ward. And the same thing was said back in 2010 during the Senate primary with John McCain and J.D. Hayworth and Jim Deacon. So I'm not surprised to see those thoughts come up again. But, of course, any reasoned, rational voter will understand that a lot of these races are driven by individuals who are in it for laudable reasons, but also for ego reasons as well.
And Shane, Senator McCain has said that he will come out fighting, and as usual, he has. A lot of money, Independent Expenditure Group has spent a lot of money to hit Kelly Ward pretty hard, which she has read, well, clearly I'm seen as a threat to them. How are you comparing in other ways this particular race to the race that Senator McCain ran against J.D. Hayworth?
Yeah, it is pretty common for John McCain during an election year to run back to the right and actually try to get on the right, further right of his primary opponent. There are two factors at play. One is he can be accurately labeled a career politician, and this is a year where career politicians are probably not going to do that well, and we've seen that with the presidential primary election. The other factor, obviously, is Donald Trump and the back and forth that has occurred between Donald Trump and John McCain over the course of the primary election cycle.
Republican strategist Shane Wickfors of Red Mountain Consulting here in the Valley. Shane, thanks as always for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
Earlier this year, Governor Ducey signed a bill into law that loosens regulations on anonymous campaign donations, or so-called dark money. Proponents called it an extension of free speech, but many others are concerned about how it could affect the political landscape. The Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting has created a new tool that will monitor dark money filings with the Secretary of State's office. And the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with one of the creators of this, and they're calling it a Twitter bot. Lauren, what exactly is a Twitter bot?
Yeah, Steve. So it's an automated program that sort of scrubs these financial filings and then tweets out the information so everyone can see it. So I talked to Evan Wyloge with AZCIR about this, and he says they developed this because they've seen a lot more dark money in recent elections here in the state.
There was some legislation that was passed this past session that deals with dark money. And what that legislation does is it locks these dark money groups into a categorization with the Secretary of State's jurisdiction that says that they will never be scrutinized for their spending and, you know, questioned as to whether they should receive the dark money categorization, which allows them to make expenditures without saying where the money comes from. Instead, they would have to become in bad standing with the IRS before anything like that would happen.
So this is going to be like a Twitter account people can follow, right? So what exactly will trigger a tweet from this bot?
So as this bot is, you know, looking at the Secretary of State's website, deciding that this expenditure is a dark money expenditure, it's going to automatically be tweeted out from AZ Dark Money Bot. That's the Twitter handle. You know, so if you're interested in that sort of stuff, just follow that account and you'll see those things come across. And they should happen within a matter of minutes.
All right. And what kind of groups are you going to be focused on with this bot? Is it 501c3s or super PACs? Anybody?
It's not just anybody. It's all of the groups that fall into a special category, which the Secretary of State refers to as IE Labor Corp LLC. Now, these are typically nonprofit groups, labor unions, or trade associations that have to file when they spend money to affect an election, but they are not classified as a political committee, so they don't ever have to file those quarterly reports or those semi-regular reports that say, here's who gave us our money.
Right. So what is this account, and what are these tweets going to tell, like, the average person? What will they be able to find out from this?
You know, they may just be curious, interested to see who's getting the dark money spent to help them or to hurt them. For reporters or journalists out there who pay attention to this stuff, we're hoping this can be a tool where they can keep an eye on this stuff and maybe look for interesting stuff as it pops up. For instance, you know, just in the last week, there was expenditures to help elect a guy named Ross Grohn and help reelect a legislator named Rusty Bowers. And there were expenditures made by two different dark money groups on the same day. So that right there is, you know, something that's interesting. Maybe if there's a reporter out there who's interested in looking into those two groups or those two candidates this time around, you know, they know right away that this is what's going on.
All right. Well, Evan Wylodge with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you.
In June, University of Arizona President Ann Weaver Hart announced she wouldn't be asking for a contract extension from the university. Hart was the subject of controversy for joining the board of for-profit DeVry while maintaining her leadership role at U of A. Some Southern Arizona lawmakers even called on Hart to resign. Now the Arizona Board of Regents has taken a big step in moving forward to find Hart's successor by announcing the chair of its search committee and issuing a request for proposals for an executive search consultant. Regent Bill Ridenour is the committee's chair, and he joins me. How important is prior leadership when looking for the next U of A president?
The U of A is a land-grant institution with two colleges of medicine, so we hope to find somebody that has knowledge of medicine and medical schools. A word that keeps coming up over and over is we're looking for someone that's innovative. As to their leadership, the U of A has a tremendous reputation nationally.
And are you looking for someone, I imagine, based on that, who can sort of hit the ground running? And as sort of a second part to that, do you think the process, I know it's early, but do you think it's important to look at someone from the standpoint of maybe the philosophies of the universities as they have been to this point, maybe some of the philosophies of the regents, but also be willing to deal with someone who may be, again, innovative being such an important word, someone who may take or want to take the university on a track that, you know, maybe isn't already set out in place at this point?
That's a very good question, because I think the regents and the search committee needs to be able to think outside the box a bit. So what kind of person would we be looking at? Confined to an academic person, someone that's a sitting president at a university right now? I don't think that may be where we'd be open to in other types of people, perhaps in government. Certainly they'd have to have an academic background, but we want to make sure that we don't confine or restrict ourselves to what I think is going to be a very small pool of candidates out there at the present time. You probably have 10 to 15 presidents or provosts or other academics out there right now that would be suitable for this job, and many of them are not actually seeking a job.
Now, Arizona is not unique in this sense. Certainly since the recession, the way that universities, state universities, are funded has changed. But is that a challenge that Arizona has that may be a little bit greater than some other states? Do you think that might make some people, even the ones you go out and look for, look at it as a great opportunity, but one that might come with inherent challenges? And do you think the committee is prepared to answer those kinds of questions?
We are. And, it's no secret that Arizona has probably had the deepest cuts in public support of higher education in the nation. Arizona, I think, turned the corner this last year. We got $32 million in additional funding from the state. We got $8 million for our funding model, which really goes to in-state students to help with their tuition. We also got $200 million in deferred payments. So all of that helped. I hope that someone coming in to the University of Arizona will see that the state does have hopefully a mission to help the universities and help the funding.
Bill Ridenour of the Arizona Board of Regents. He's leading the search committee to find the U of A's next president. The effect of music on Alzheimer's disease has been considered before, and arts programs have been used in the attempt to help reopen a hidden part of a dementia patient's brain. The Phoenix Symphony has taken the connection a step further. A pilot program started 2 years ago to look for ways that may help reduce stress in Alzheimer's patients, caregivers, and loved ones. The study was done with 48 people, 12 in each of four categories of dementia. Jim Ward is president and CEO of the Phoenix Symphony and joins us to talk more about this. Jim, now that the study has been going on for 2 years or so, what conclusions have been drawn?
We walked away once the study was tabulated with quantitative data that did prove the efficacy of those interventions. We, in fact, did reduce stress levels statistically, quantifiably in those patients, in those caregivers, in those family members, and as fun with our musicians. And this was so striking that Dr. David Kuhn, who led this study for us from ASU, was asked to speak last November at the Gerontological Society convention in Orlando to present initial results. And he's going back to the same group this year. It's in New Orleans to present even further findings that we have now uncovered since then.
I think we're taught to think of stress as being a negative, but we also hear the terms good stress and bad stress. Is there a way for this study to measure that?
In general, there is a large magnitude of stress in Alzheimer's that isn't just negative. It's just bad pretty much wherever you go. And the interesting part about this study is a benchmark, the control, if you will, that was used to measure these stress levels against was an undoubtedly stressful situation that these patients would face in the afternoon, which was bathing. Particularly with very progressive Alzheimer's, the bathing process is very stressful across the board. It's the patient is not happy at all. The caregiver, it's a real chore to do it. The family member, particularly if they're involved in it. So we were able to measure these variances based on a control of what normally happens. And if there was a musical intervention, not only did we do pre and post with the biomarkers, but we also measured that on the days where there was musical intervention and they had to be bathed versus the days it didn't, and what were the differences there, et cetera. So both qualitatively and quantitatively, we could tease out that particular issue pretty scientifically.
If you were thinking about the next level steps for something like this, is there something that you hope for? Is there something you think is actually realistic when it comes to making a difference? And I mean in a bigger way.
Our vision for this is a next step in terms of scientific protocol is we now want to go out and replicate this data in a different facility, in a facility that has a different demography and a different service set, if you will. And once we've been able to replicate this data, hopefully positively, we then would like to go to the NIH with a grant where we could expand this significantly into multiple facilities, with the hope that at the end of the day, we could have a program and protocol that is replicable anywhere in the world, because anywhere in the world there are musicians. They can, in fact, learn these techniques, this protocol, what this whole program is, relatively easily, and under the right guidance and supervision, this can be done anywhere. And that's just very, very exciting for us. But most importantly for us, the immediate impact is to on this particular community and what we could do here.
Do you think that based on actually having scientific results, that this will make others inclined to jump on board? Because it is more than just anecdotal.
Oh, you bet. The traditional orchestral approach is to say, you know, music feeds the souls of people, and it's very nice, and people feel good. And so give us some money, and we'll go out and make people feel good. And when times are tough, particularly, and or when health and human services and the impact of that maybe rightly so ranks higher than just purely giving money to the arts, we now can go in and say, listen, we are impacting over 125,000 individuals in this valley every year. We are a health and services agency. We are an education agency. Don't think of us as an orchestra. We're using that as a means to an end to positively impact. And by the way, here is the quantitative data that proves the efficacy of these efforts, which is far more than a lot of organizations ever have in proving what they're doing.
Jim Ward is president and CEO of the Phoenix Symphony. And Jim, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Now we'll pirouette from music for the brain to music for the body. The show's Annika Klein introduces us to a ballet teacher in the Valley who teaches classes specially choreographed for those with Parkinson's disease.
Lower the heels, one arm out to the side. One.
My background is in dance. I started dancing when I was 3.
Debbie Braganza grew up in ballet slippers. She studied dance and went on to teach classes to adults and children. 5 years ago, she started a ballet class specifically for people with Parkinson's disease, a disorder with many symptoms, including loss of motor control.
Toes out, standing up nice and tall, plie, now brush off.
My father has Parkinson's. He's had it for over 20 years.
Her father's disease and her own love for dance merged when she found out about a program from Brooklyn called Dance for PD. Braganza trained with that program and now teaches 3 classes around the valley.
She's trained to design these for arm limitations.
Marlene Blakeney takes the class at Ballet Arizona. They do warm-up exercises on chairs so they don't have to focus on balance right away.
Lift the toes up, tap the heels.
Blakeney says she's taken dance before.
When I was 6 years old, I didn't practice at home, so I didn't get very good and I gave it up pretty quickly.
She picked it up again this spring. Doctors encourage Parkinson's patients like Blakeney to be active to maintain their mobility. Dance is probably one of the tougher options.
My muscles don't always want to do what I want them to do. Your body is saying, no, you're not going to go that way.
But Blakeney says the rhythm of the music keeps her in step.
And to stay with the class and the music and what's going on, you kind of have to push it and force it and take the control back a little bit.
And 7, we glide 4 times, glide.
Each class, Braganza guides the group across the dance floor. Canes and walkers lean against the wall as the dancers turn in time with the beat. Braganza says she sees now how exercise plays into a holistic treatment of the disease.
The medicine's just not enough. They now get a prescription for medicine and exercise, and they're of equal importance. You have to take your medicine and you have to exercise.
You know, if exercise came in a pill, it would be the most widely prescribed medication on the universe.
Dr. Darylyn O'Donnell is with the Muhammad Ali Parkinson Center in Phoenix. She says any exercise is good, but dance especially helps improve the connection between mind and body.
Dancers have to think about how they move, and with Parkinson's, that loss of dopamine has affected their spontaneity of movement. So people with Parkinson's, much like dancers, have to think about how they're going to move.
Research shows exercise may slow the progression of Parkinson's, and O'Donnell says dance targets many of the symptoms, with flexibility, starting a movement, transitioning.
Now we go to feet, and a 1-2 hold, 1-2 hold.
And for Marlene Blakeney, it's realizing that what she can do on the dance floor, she can do anywhere.
I have felt at times when I've been out, like grocery shopping, give me a basket and let me lean on it and support myself and drag myself through the store. And then I start moving and I start thinking, I can do better than this. Straighten up my shoulders and stand a little taller.
Just like a dancer. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
The lives of thousands of small-scale coffee growers in Latin America and Mexico are better off because of fair trade. But the system is fraying at the seams in one of the world's most important coffee-growing regions because of a perfect storm. Low prices, a damaging fungus, and unscrupulous middlemen. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Lorne Matalon reports.
Xahul, Guatemala, in the highlands near the border with Mexico. Central America and southern Mexico are major parts of the fair trade coffee mosaic. 80% of the world's fair trade coffee comes from Latin America. They pay well, says coffee grower Pedro Pacheco in Xahul. He's in a fair trade coffee co-op. That's where growers sell their coffee together, sharing risk and reward. He says his co-op works well because its foreign buyers pay a fair price that's locked in and doesn't change even if market conditions do. Fair trade represents around 5% of the world's coffee market. But first, what is fair trade coffee? It means people willingly pay a few cents more for their cup to ensure growers get a fair return on their labor. For growers, fair trade also means relationships with buyers that include cash advances and a steady outlet for the beans. But that virtuous cycle depends on a lot of players, and if they're not all in sync, the system can falter. Now let's cross from Guatemala into southern Mexico, where Paulino Agustin and two friends are hunkered down on a mountain cloaked in volcanic soil.
Haciendo hollada y rellenándolo de abono.
I'm digging and fertilizing, says Agustin. He's planting coffee trees. But it'll take 3 years for these trees to start delivering the beans, says his colleague Sinael Altamirano.
Aquí no, no money.
There's no money here, he says. Despite the good intentions of fair trade, the coffee industry as a whole is suffering. Coffee prices are low worldwide.
Fair trade, it's not a perfect system, and it's definitely not a magic wand that can fix all the world's problems.
Monica Furl used to live in Chiapas. She moved there to learn the business and ended up helping to organize a fair trade coffee co-op. Now she's back in Montreal. She imports fair trade coffee from three Chiapas co-ops for coffee shops and roasters in the U.S. and Canada.
Coffee prices are set at a commodities market. So for the farmer, what that means is wildly fluctuating prices that are based more on buying and selling of futures contracts rather than the labor and the care that the farmers put into the fields. And
Furl says the key to making fair trade work is finding co-op leaders who'll negotiate honestly with foreign buyers. There are stories strewn across Chiapas about leaders who make money for themselves by cutting their own deals with go-betweens.
If these farmers can't get organized in effective exporting cooperatives, they are essentially left at the mercy of the local middlemen, or los coyotes, as they call them in Chiapas.
Yeah.
We do call them coyotes, says 72-year-old Ermelino Mendez. They drive the price down. But these days, he's torn. He says his co-op just isn't getting the job done. That's why he sold to coyotes last year on the side. They paid a higher price than his own co-op would or could. He's not really sure.
No disfrutamos de nuestro producto y nuestro trabajo.
We're not benefiting from our work, he says. And now, besides low prices, a devastating fungus called coffee rust, which some scientists say is a consequence of climate change. Until 3 years ago, coffee rust hadn't been seen at these altitudes. Again, Monica Furl.
And then they lose 30, 50, maybe 75% of their total production after years of building up their fields. It's very demoralizing.
Entire coffee-growing communities in Central America and southern Mexico have been abandoned because of coffee rust. Now the focus is on planting strains of coffee that are better equipped to resist climate change. But because it takes 3 years for new trees to mature, that won't help fair trade coffee or the industry as a whole in the short term. Lorne Matalon, KJZZ News, Chiapas, Mexico.
It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're talking to the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. When that love seat or set of saucepans needs a new home, you might think about donating it to charity. But who takes those items and preps them for resale? Today we wander into a day on the job sorting donated goods.
I'm Darian Walters. I'm the head donation attendant at Goodwill, Ahwatukee Foothill Stores. Besides the manager, I'm the first person here. And it's my job just to come back here and make sure the whole room is clear for all the processors to start working. So we have about 60 donations a day. Pretty much every day we have donations that come to the door, and it's my job to take them, sort them out, and then give them to processors where they're able to process it, price it, and put it on the floor to sell. You got to be able to reach the back door and throughout the whole warehouse in 10 seconds. You got to be able to greet the donor. And whenever one of these bins is full right here, we move it to the main wall over here, and then we just got to swap it out with them. Each Gaylord weighs about empty, 100 pounds each. And then when they're filled up, they probably weigh anywhere from 250, anywhere from the heaviest boats is probably, well, I have no idea. Heavy though. They wanted a real physical job, and that's what this is. It's like a small workout throughout the whole day. And a lot of the furniture we get is something called home pickup. And it's just one big truck that comes by, and it's just loaded to the top with furniture, couches, dressers. We do those about twice a week. That's why I'm sweaty, and it takes about 40 minutes to an hour to do that. The weirdest thing so far that I've had donated to me is a big bag of frozen food. And it was macaroni and small pizzas. And the lady didn't even say anything, actually. It's pretty funny. Like it a lot, yeah. Everyone back here is like a small little family, I guess.
That's Darian Walters sorting through donations at Goodwill. And in KJZZ News at 2:40, the last confirmed case of Zika in Arizona was on Friday, bringing the statewide total to 13. All of them have been travel-related. Now the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have advised people to avoid a neighborhood north of Miami, Florida, where multiple localized cases have occurred. The Zika virus is spread by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is found in Arizona. Tom Frieden, director of the CDC, says the Zika virus is spread in a very different way compared to other mosquito-borne diseases.
There isn't an animal reservoir, so unlike West Nile, which persists in the bird population and can affect an entire state, with Zika, it is quite focal and generally requires that mosquitoes get reinfected or infected by people who are infected.
Frieden says the Aedes aegypti mosquito only travels about a mile in its lifetime, so most cases of Zika are localized. It's only when those infected go into crowded populations that the disease is more easily spread. It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. Along with John Hockenberry from The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. Who's got Olympic fever? Are you like me, ready for some track and field and high diving? The Olympic torch is making its way around Brazil in the lead-up to the Rio 2016 Games that begin this Friday. The torch is burning bright in Rio das Ostras, a small coastal town in Brazil.
The torch relay ends on Friday when the final torch bearer will light the Olympic cauldron in a stadium in Rio. As we get ready to light the torch, so to speak, our guide to the Olympic Games and all of its traditions will be David Goldblatt. He's the author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, a Herculean effort that tries to draw a line from its ancient roots to today's modern commercial cash cow.
It's an attempt to do justice to the real political and cultural history of the Olympics. I mean, there's an awful lot of books out there on the Olympics and an awful lot of guides, but very few of them will really explore, you know, what are the political, economic, and cultural reasons that people have been prepared to stage this spectacular, and what does it really mean?
And the Olympics are charting a history of what nationhood means, in a way, right?
Well, it's one aspect of it. I mean, one of the paradoxes of the Olympics that it is simultaneously the greatest and most public expression of a cosmopolitan humanity that we have, at the same time that it sort of systematically encourages and nurtures a particular kind of sporting nationalism and competition. So there's a real tension in the Olympic Games, as there is in kind of, you know, the wider politics of the 20th and 21st century, between attempts to create a sense of internationalism, of cosmopolitanism, to break down borders between ethnicities and nations, to represent a singular humanity through the playing and experience of sport. And on the other hand, the most terrible sort of atavistic racist nationalism is on display. So it becomes a global public theatre for these kind of wider political and cultural struggles.
In the 20th century, during the Cold War, when I came of age watching the Olympics, you know, it was a kind of a good guys, bad guys narrative. Was that even remotely the case in 400 AD when this began?
No, I don't think there is quite the same sort of singular good guys, bad guys, simple, if effective, narrative of the Cold War conflicts. But you do have an awful lot riding on the ancient Olympic Games, which of course was only one of a whole wider circuit of incredibly important pan-Hellenic games. And so there was enormous civic pride associated with triumph at the Olympics, and one could certainly trade and bargain a victory at the Olympic Games for status and political office, and often effectively prize money once one got back to Athens or Sparta or wherever one came from. So again, with the ancient Olympics, there's also a pan-Hellenic side, the idea that despite this competition between different city-states, there is also this sense of being all Greeks and finding some sort of common ground to celebrate your collectivity.
Is it the case, I mean, we sort of think almost as a cliche that the Olympics are a proxy for actual war, that in a peaceful world there would just be the Olympics, but originally, there was a wartime context to the games themselves.
Well, not really in ancient Greece. I mean, you have the idea of a truce, which Baron de Coubertin and the International Olympic Committee have completely turned into a mythology, as if the whole of the Hellenic world stopped all of its conflicts for the Olympic Games. And this, of course, is a complete untruth. All that was agreed at the time is that there would be safe passage across areas of conflict for athletes going to the Games. But in no way were the Games ever stopped. I mean, indeed, on one occasion, there was actually a pitched battle fought at the Olympic Games in the 5th century. Mm. So the relationship between the modern Games and the ancient Games is actually very complicated. And most of what we've inherited from the IOC, who are amongst the worst classical scholars in the whole of human history, is incredibly distorted. I mean, you know, the idea of sort of amateurism that the IOC, you know, often, I mean, as late as the 1960s, President Avery Brundage is defending his contemporary sense of amateurism by saying, but that's of course what the ancient Greeks were doing. And while there was no prize money at Olympia, there was of course a gigantic professional circuit of sport across the whole ancient world. And there was no way that, you know, taking money or prize money from the Isthmian Games or the Pythian Games would have disbarred you from the Olympic Games. And that's part of the problem with the IOC, and indeed their whole way of talking about the Olympics, is that they have systematically gone to the history and distorted it for contemporary political purposes.
Great story and fabulously told. The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. David Goldblatt is the author. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. After falling one game short of the Super Bowl last season, the Arizona Cardinals have opened training camp in Glendale with high hopes. KJZZ's Phil Latzman joins us now. And Phil, lots of optimism among Valley football fans.
I would say so. You're one of them. I'm one of them. And that means lots of expectations. And you really get the feeling that it's Super Bowl or bust for this team. And I mean win the Super Bowl or bust, especially with the Cardinals star players beginning to age a bit, Steve. Now, this might be their last chance.
Good. There you go. Good. Stay low. Work yourself low.
And following 2 days of practice in shorts, it was time to put the pads on yesterday.
Biggest thing is both lines of scrimmage, offense, defense, get your pads down. All right? And learn to play with it.
Yes, time to separate the men from the boys for head coach Bruce Arians, who is happy with the early results.
Really pleased with where we're at right now as far as getting out of shorts. A lot of the mental work's done. Now it's time to get the physical part of it started and making sure that we get our pad level down and start playing football.
But for most veterans, like defensive lineman Calais Campbell, training camp can be a drag.
It usually takes a few more days, you know, a couple days in pads before you really start, you know, feeling it. But, you know, it is what it is. Training camp is a grind. It always has been. It always will be.
Cardinals star receiver Larry Fitzgerald enters his 13th season with Arizona and is candid about how he feels about this time of the year.
Nothing's different. Training camp stinks when you're bad. Training camp stinks when you're good. It's training camp, man. And 30 minutes from home, you know, sleeping in a hotel. I mean, but it's a job, and, you know, you focus on what you can control, and that's your effort every day, getting out here and getting better and, going through the but not in this process of training camp.
But it certainly doesn't look that way out on the practice field as Fitzgerald hauls in a long pass from his veteran teammate, quarterback Carson Palmer, who says it doesn't seem like a grind because this is a special bunch.
It's a group that loves to work. It's a group that enjoys the game, and it's not pulling teeth. And there's guys that aren't fretting. You know, you don't have those guys who are like, oh, man, it's training camp. We've got guys who are excited about training camp.
Palmer is now 36 and coming off arguably his best season as a pro. But the clock is ticking on his NFL career. He's hoping he can go out on top like one of his childhood idols, John Elway, as a Super Bowl winner.
You don't know until you're in that position, but I think all the time about Elway's run, his last 2 years, and how special that was. You know, I remember those like they were not too long ago because I used to live in Colorado also as a young kid, so I watched the Broncos, and watching that career come to an end was pretty special.
But perhaps with the most sense of urgency to win is Larry Fitzgerald, a possible future Hall of Famer, entering the final year of his contract with the Cardinals. The 33-year-old said he has no idea if this will be his last season in Arizona or for good, joking, quote, I don't even know what I'm having for dinner tonight. He does say his career goals have boiled down to this.
There's only one thing that I want. You know, I just want to win a championship. That's it. That's it.
Meanwhile, the Cardinals are becoming quite the media darlings. They are featured in the Amazon acclaimed series, All or Nothing. It chronicles Arizona's 13-3 season last year, which concluded in that blowout loss in the NFC title game to the Carolina Panthers.
You're going to look back at this point in your life, and you either took advantage of the opportunity or you blew it.
Put another way, are you ready to go all in? That's the question the Cardinals faced in 2015.
And, Steve, the Cardinals play their first preseason game in Glendale next Friday, August 12th, against the Oakland Raiders. They'll open the regular season Sunday night, September 11th, at home against another team that made the NFL's Final Four last season, the New England Patriots. You knew what that means.
And, Phil, the timing's serendipitous because of the whole Deflategate scandal. No Tom Brady.
No Tom Brady. Of course, you will not be playing in that regular season opener against the Cardinals, serving that four-game suspension for his role in the infamous Deflategate affair.
And Phil, the Cardinals get a lot of attention for that offense, but on defense, they're looking pretty strong too. But a key player, All-Pro safety Tyrann Mathieu, coming off a tough injury.
Yeah, the ACL injury last year that he sustained, it's been 8 months. Bruce Arians, the Cardinals head coach, knowing how important Tyrann Mathieu is to the team, is keeping him out of the early part of training camp. And the Cardinals are going to have big decisions to make. Their defensive line is very solid. There's a lot of guys competing for jobs there. So it'll be interesting to see. Definitely, I think the backbone of the team is the defense.
KJZZ's Phil Latsman previewing the Arizona Cardinals. Phil, thanks.
Thanks, Steve. It's football season again.
Monday, Monday, can't trust that day. Monday, Monday, sometimes it just turns out that way.
Hey, guys.
What's up, G?
Want to go to Tchotchke's? Get some coffee?
Oh, it's a little early. I
got to get out of here. I think I'm going to lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
So it's Monday, the day of the week that is usually accompanied by pessimism and gloom. Most people look forward to Fridays or Saturdays, but Mondays don't get that luxury. But there are different perspectives on what Mondays really mean. And today I'm joined by writer Deborah Sussman. Deborah, do you love or hate Mondays?
I did what I usually do, which is I reached out to other people and said, you know, how do you feel about Monday? And the first person I asked was my husband, and it was very interesting. He said, when I worked at blank, let's just say it was a job where he wasn't very happy, he said, I hated Mondays. Yeah. Now I work for myself, and Monday's another day, so Monday doesn't bother me at all. So then I started thinking about when I was in school, let's say like middle school and high school, I did not like Mondays, but I think that's because I didn't like where I was going. I realized Monday's really a referendum on what you're going to be doing Monday morning. And if you like your job, you're in good shape. So I love my job. I mean, I know I sound like I've been brainwashed, but I work with amazing people and I work in the arts, and I'm always really excited to see, you know, my colleagues and to keep working on stories. And so I really think if you have a Monday to Friday job and you hate Mondays, maybe step back and look at your job and think about, is this really what I want to be doing with my life?
Have you ever had that feeling that there are some people who really, really focus on the weekends? Yeah, it's the whole yep. work hard, play hard sort of thing.
Yep.
And I wonder with some people if like the Monday morning thing feels worse because not only did they maybe sleep in on Sunday, but also maybe went out with friends, stayed out a little bit later, had some wine, whatever it is. And then Monday morning, it's like, wait a second, the alarm's going off at 5:30. In order to sort of counteract the potential dread of the Sunday night, you go out and do something a little bit more fun, which may affect you on Monday.
I will confess to having done that a lot more when I lived in New York and was younger, and I watched my teenage daughter do it. And it's really hard because I know what's going to happen, right, when she makes a plan late on Sunday night and she needs to be somewhere Monday morning. So we've talked a lot about you need to be realistic. But, you know, on the other hand, I feel like Sundays were always the day that I dreaded. So I also understand trying to cram more joy into Sunday. I'm sure many people do. I bet actually a lot of people, because of the way, you know, we sort of see Sunday as the end of our time and kind of moving into, and yet that isn't what it is for me. I'm not sure what it is, and I've tried to write about it a little bit, and I brought the beginning of a poem that I wrote. Well, and I should also explain that my father was born in Germany in 1928. And he and his parents were refugees, so that plays into the poem. The poem is called Exile. After my father died, before I surrendered to Prozac, it was always Sunday in my heart. Sunday at my parents' house, and I am 16, waiting for my life to begin, drinking tea on the living room sofa while my mother and father read the New York Times, and Brahms plays from the speakers, Passion, Mastered. There are small butter cookies on a porcelain plate. They come from a lovely package from my father's fatherland, and they nourish only memory. There is no future here. There is no past. Late light through the window pane makes my heart ache. On this eternal Sunday, I know that someday my father's death will break my heart in two. Before and after, and no in between.
Writer Deborah Sussman, thanks for joining us for part of this Monday series, Deborah.
You're very welcome, Steve. Thank you.
Remember punching in a VHS tape when you wanted to watch a movie at home? Maybe you still do that, or maybe it's been a little while, and maybe your VCR is long gone, replaced with DVDs and online streaming. But these machines were still being made until last week. The show's Annika Klein says the last company making VCRs in the world decided to power off.
Funai Electric is a Japanese electronics company. On their website, you'll find glossy flat-screen TVs and sleek DVD and Blu-ray players. But last week, a representative from the company told me this in an email.
Funai will stop making video cassette recorders, VCRs, VCR-DVD combos by the end of this month due to difficulty acquiring parts, mainly.
And after detailing some sales numbers, it ends on a bit of a mournful note.
We are the last manufacturer of VCRs in all of the world, indeed.
But not everyone is offering their condolences.
Well, I don't know that it much matters to me. I haven't owned one in 20 years, so.
No sympathy. We turned the VCRs that we had into something that we could just store on our computer.
It feels like the time. We're two iterations beyond VHS, so I'm ready to say goodbye.
Moviegoers Gary, Randall, and Aaron are among a crowd spilling out of the Harkins Camel View Theater in Scottsdale. The sentiment here seems to be out with the old, in with the new. Movie watching methods evolve, and so do the habits of the viewers. So I stopped by a place more familiar with the way things were.
Well, this is Melrose Electronics. He's been here since 1957.
Richard Heaton has been repairing TVs since they had tubes in them, and VCRs since they came out in the 70s. Surely he must be sad to see them go.
There is no money to be made on DVDs and VCRs.
Heaton says he used to repair a lot of VCRs.
The peak for me was in the early 1990s, and we would get 10 to 20 VCRs a day.
Back when people were punching in flicks like The Sandlot, Shawshank Redemption, and, of course,
My name's Forrest, Forrest Gump.
VCRs had a good run. Funai Electronics saw its peak sales in the early 2000s. But then came DVDs, and the combination DVD-VCR player hit the market. And repair shops hit a wall.
I tried so many times to fix those. VCR-DVD combos without the tuner are almost not repairable.
There are stacks of them in Heaton's store, useless now. So if you are feeling nostalgic and you would like to revive some old VHS tapes, here's his recommendation.
If you get a VCR back in the early 1990s, they were the really good ones.
And we can also look to the 90s for one last reason why someone might want to hold on to that VCR player. Home movies. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.